Welcome back. It's the third hour of Issues Etc. today. We're coming to you live. As I return back to the studios here today, live Wednesday, March 31st. I spent about 5 days over the weekend in Dallas welcoming home my younger brother after a year in Iraq, and it was a great time with the family and to see him reunited with his wife and his daughter as well. But it's good to be back here as well. And in the last hour, we're going to spend some time talking about, well, at least according to the number of chapters given him by Moses in the book of Genesis, a rather important figure. How much of this is simply backstory to the Exodus, and how much of this story of Joseph is just kind of a colorful way of rounding off and transitioning between the time of Abraham, his sons and his grandsons, and the time when the children of Israel become a great nation? We'll be talking about all of that with Dr. Walter A. Meyer III during this hour of Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers, if you have a question or comment on Joseph the Patriarch, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Walter A. Meyer III is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He's Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Meyer, welcome back.
Good to be back, Todd. I'm looking forward to this today.
The last 13 chapters of the first book of the Bible is devoted entirely to this one person. In fact, after saying Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojourning in the land of Canaan, here are the generations of Jacob. It begins there in verse 2, Joseph, a 17-year-old miscreant there of one of Jacob's sons. Why so much time devoted to Joseph, his life, his comings and his goings?
Okay. Almost, as you say, Todd, almost exactly, 13 chapters. There's one chapter 38, which is like a little excursus that's dealing with Judah and Tamar. But yes, almost entirely aside from that, dealing with Joseph. And the reasons are these. This is continuing the patriarchal narrative, which began with Abraham back in the end of chapter 11 of Genesis, and then really beginning with chapter 12. And this is the story of God fulfilling his plan of salvation, involving now the descendants of Abraham. God had promised the deliverer back in Genesis 3:15 for fallen humanity. And in Genesis 12, we see that this deliverer will come from the family of Abraham, and then from the descendants of Isaac, and then from the descendants of Jacob. So this is a very important element in salvation history. Also, we can say this. These last chapters of Genesis do indeed set the background for Exodus. We see how the Israelites came to settle in Egypt. And then Exodus picks up some centuries later after the end of Genesis. And yes, by that time the Israelites have grown into a large nation. They are enslaved in need of deliverance. And so we have the mighty miracles and God rescuing them. But background for that is given to us at the end of Genesis. But in addition to those reasons, we also have this, that Joseph's story is simply fascinating in itself. It's tremendous literature, just from the literary standpoint. Talk about drama, talk about sudden twists. But beyond that, powerful theology. And we have displayed for us both law and gospel. And in the background of all that, then, the promise of the Messiah. And because of the Messiah, there can be good news. Because of the Messiah, there is this matter of forgiveness and people living to God's glory. So, tremendous theology as well in these last chapters of Genesis.
At the end of the account of Joseph, he emerges as a man of great compassion and mercy, who understands God's mercy toward him and meets that out to his brothers unknowingly at first. But in the first few chapters of this story, it's not a flattering picture of Joseph or of his brothers either. These are the patriarchs of Israel. They don't seem to behave like it.
That's exactly true. Nor is it a flattering picture of Jacob, actually, at the very beginning, because we start off with chapter 37, and we see it's a real mess in the camp of Jacob. He is showing blatant favoritism to one of his sons. Now, that's a no-no, to show favoritism to a child. Joseph himself, yeah, he shows a bit of pride, a bit of arrogance. He is the one who brings a report to his father concerning his brother's bad behavior, and that was okay in itself, but maybe he also took some pride in it. But beyond that, when he has then these dreams indicating that his brothers will bow down to him someday, he told them the first dream, and okay, maybe he can get away with it the first time, but when he saw the reaction of intense anger, he should have had sensitivity and not told them the second dream, but he has to go ahead and tell it anyway. So you get a sense that Joseph knows he's his father's favorite, and he doesn't mind inflaming his brothers a little bit. And then as far as his brothers are concerned, the text says that they hated him. And the Bible speaks in very severe terms with regard to hatred and where a person is spiritually when the person is engaging in hatred. And later on, they even want to kill him. And then the best a couple of brothers can do, or in Judah in particular, is to sell him rather than kill him. You know, sell him as a slave and get rid of him that way. And then they go on to deceive their father, just outright lie to their father as to what happened to Joseph. So this is a mess in the camp. Jacob certainly has sensed this friction. He doesn't do much to diffuse it. And Joseph doesn't help matters, and the brothers are not in a good spiritual condition. So, yeah, it's not a pretty scene.
Before we go on with the story, both at the beginning and at the end, or near the end of this story, dreams figure prominently into this, along with other Old Testament stories as well. But Joseph has his dreams that eventually come true in a form. Later, Pharaoh will have his dreams, and Joseph is the only one able to interpret them. What do we make of this kind of form of revelation, if you will?
Well, I think it's interesting. The text never says in chapter 37 that the dreams that Joseph had actually came from God. I know that's a common perception, but you don't actually find that in the text. It simply says that Joseph had a dream, and then he had another dream, but doesn't say explicitly that these dreams came from God. And later on, yes, we had the butler and the baker having dreams, and then also Pharaoh. So I think we have to sort of leave that as a question as to their origin. But, yeah, ultimately in control of everything is God. And as far as Joseph being the only one able to interpret, that was a particular gift that God gave to Joseph. He was going to be using this man in a very mighty way. And his interpretation of dreams served God's purposes to have Joseph recognized and then eventually elevated so that he could be in a position then, the second most powerful man in Egypt, to be God's instrument to preserve the covenant family, the Israelites, from starvation.
In Sunday school, we get kind of a piecemeal picture of Joseph, a story here, a story there, usually with the more PG-13 sections cut out. Give us a run-through of the entire Joseph story.
Well, we start off at chapter 37. We've already talked about the situation in Jacob's camp and how Joseph then was telling these dreams. And in fact, Jacob senses Joseph's gone a little too far, and he has to give him a rebuke, you know, about this. But then we have this situation where Joseph then is sold by his brothers into slavery. And you have to just consider then, you know, what a traumatic circumstance that was for Joseph. Here he was in the camp, his father's favorite, and Jacob was a wealthy man. And now he's reduced to being a piece of property, like on the same level as some animals. And he is being taken by foreigners to a foreign land. And he doesn't know what awaits him in Egypt. And When he finally arrives in Egypt, and then he is in Egypt. This is picking up with chapter 39, and there he is purchased by Potiphar, an official of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, the captain of the guard. And God is gracious to Joseph, and the text says that the Lord was with him. And that's a theme in the life of Joseph. The Lord was with him, and his master Potiphar recognizes this, and so things turn for the better for Joseph in Potiphar's house. And Potiphar gradually entrusts more and more to Joseph. He sees his skill in management. He sees it as a man of noble character and trustworthy. And so in the end, it says he left everything in Joseph's care. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. But then we have the next scene where he is being tempted by Potiphar's wife. Joseph is a good-looking man. Potiphar's wife notices this. We don't know how much Potiphar was around the house. And then she has plans for Joseph, and she's trying to tempt him into breaking the sixth commandment. But Joseph, by this time, certainly with his hard experience of being sold by his brothers and taken to a foreign land, reduced to a slave, has learned the proper fear of the Lord. And so at one point he says, no, I can't do this and sin against God. But then she catches his cloak as he's running away from temptation, fleeing temptation. And she suddenly now turns against him. She had wanted him, but now she turns against him. And she accuses him falsely, of course, of attempted rape. Now, this is very interesting. When Potiphar comes home, and she reports this to him, and she has this cloak of Joseph as evidence, it says, the text says that he burned with anger. It doesn't say he burned with anger against Joseph. It just says he burns with anger. And Todd, I firmly believe that he was angry, not because he believed his wife, but because he knew that she was telling a falsehood against Joseph. He was convinced of his noble character. He trusted him with everything. He probably also knew the character of his wife. But here you have now an Egyptian bringing an accusation against a Hebrew. Well, you have to go with the word of an Egyptian. Furthermore, it was the wife of the master against a slave. So Potiphar felt trapped. He had to do something with regard to Joseph, even though he knew that Joseph was innocent. That's why he's angry. He's going to lose his valuable servant. But we read next, what does he do to him? You know, attempted rape, that's a pretty serious thing against the master's wife. Potiphar put him in prison, relatively light sentence. And also it says he put him in the king's prison, where the king's prisoners were confined. And perhaps that was kind of a special prison then for special prisoners. Well, we read that Joseph in prison then was still encouraged by the Lord. The Lord was with him. And the Lord granted him favor in the eyes of the warden. By the way, chapter 40, we learn that this warden is Potiphar. And apparently this prison was close to, if not right next to, Potiphar's house. And Potiphar is the prison chief. So Potiphar has him still close by. And he again entrusts more and more to Joseph. And in fact, when we have then two very important prisoners, the cupbearer and the baker of the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, Potiphar, the warden, entrusts them to Joseph to take care of them. And Joseph does his job well, and he's also very sensitive, and he can tell when they are bothered by something, and he inquires, and they go on to tell him then about their dreams. And Joseph then is able to give an interpretation of their dreams. And, of course, what Joseph foretold actually takes place. But the man who was released from prison, the cupbearer, did not remember Joseph. That's at the end of chapter 40. He forgot him. And perhaps this was an intentional forgetting. He doesn't want to remember this embarrassing incident in his life when he was in prison and then also encountered Joseph. Or maybe he really got busy with his work again and did forget him. So you have Joseph then hoping to, you know, have a good word spoken for him outside of the prison by this cupbearer, but the man forgot him, and Joseph continues in prison for, you know, two more years. So it's one thing after another. He was taken down to Egypt, and then he experienced some elevation in the house of Potiphar. And then the crushing blow, this false accusation by Potiphar's wife, and he's put in prison, as a slave now in prison. But he's experiencing some elevation in prison and hope now for a good word from the cupbearer, but he forgets about him. But in all this, God is refining Joseph and preparing him for his sudden elevation to power, which will soon take place. Now, you've heard this phrase, power corrupts. And a man who had not been so prepared as Joseph would have been perhaps corrupted by suddenly having all this power. But Joseph was ready. God made him ready so that when he was elevated, he retained his noble character, his faith in the Lord, and he showed his faith in his life. All right. Well, then we have eventually Pharaoh having his dreams, and then the cupbearer remembers Joseph, how he could interpret, and Joseph comes out. And he does interpret Pharaoh's dreams, that there are going to be these 7 years of plenty, but then followed by seven severe years of famine. And so Joseph interprets the dreams correctly, and then he also gives a plan of action for the Egyptians to follow in preparation for this coming famine. Make use of these bountiful years, make the most of them, store up so you're ready then for the years of deprivation. And the Egyptians are impressed. Perhaps Joseph was thinking more, if the most I can get out of this now is my freedom, he would have been happy. But the Egyptians recognize, again, that there's a supernatural power with Joseph. And in a time of crisis, they're going to put aside any kind of biases against foreigners. And they're not going to mess around. They want to choose the most able man. They see that this man is Joseph. And so all agree with Pharaoh's choice. And Pharaoh makes Joseph now suddenly the most powerful man in Egypt. Only Pharaoh is above him. But otherwise, Joseph basically has the same power as Pharaoh. And so now he is put in charge of collecting and preparing for the famine. Now that sets the stage then for Joseph's brothers coming down to Egypt. And this is some 20-plus years later. And the famine has spread as far as the land of Canaan, where Joseph's brothers and father and the whole family are living. And so by necessity, they have to come down to Egypt. They've heard that food is there, and it's been stored up. All right, they eventually come then to the presence of Joseph, who is watching over the selling of the food and managing that very, very carefully. Joseph would recognize his brothers. They would stand out from the crowd as Hebrews with their particular type of dress. They'd be shepherds. The brothers would not recognize Joseph. You got to think that 20-some years have passed. Joseph was last seen by them when he was 17 years old. Now he's 38 or older. So that would bring about a physical change. He's also now in the garb and appearance of an Egyptian. And the Egyptians shaved their heads. They shaved off their beards. They wore makeup. This is including the men. They wore headdresses. The men wore fake beards. He would have had on Egyptian clothes. And furthermore, Joseph, you know, would have been using an interpreter. He understood what they were saying, but he would have used an interpreter as, part of his keeping himself not revealed to his brothers. And so all this adds up to the brothers not recognizing Joseph. Furthermore, they thought they would never see him again on this earth. They thought he was gone for good. And certainly, it couldn't be this man who was this powerful leader in Egypt. So Joseph recognizes his brothers. They don't recognize him. And now we have this. God is using Joseph as his tool to refine the brothers. And Joseph now wants to see where they are from the standpoint of character. And again, God will use him to bring about a smoothing out of the brothers, refining, wearing off some of their rough edges. And it's not then a matter of vengeance on the part of Joseph when he's acting this way with his brothers. It's not a matter of his playing around with them, having fun with them. No. This is all very serious to Joseph, and he loves his brothers. He's forgiven them long ago. He wants to reveal himself. He has to restrain himself. He has to see, first of all, again, where they are from the spiritual standpoint, from the standpoint of character, and then also be God's instrument for refining. So that's then what follows next. To summarize the following chapters, Todd, Joseph tests his brothers in various ways, puts them through certain crises, and under the pressure of a crisis, then, these brothers show that they have indeed changed. God uses Joseph to change them, and in the end, these brothers also emerge as noble characters. Judah is their spokesman in chapter 44, and he is willing to be a slave in place of his brother Benjamin. Joseph was going to keep Benjamin behind as a slave, as part of his test of the brothers. But Judah says, no, take me. And so we have a reversal now, in essence. Before, the brothers had sold Joseph into slavery, but now Judah, and no doubt he was speaking the mind of all the brothers, is willing to be a slave himself to preserve his brother Benjamin from that. And so Joseph sees now that his brothers have changed. They are indeed noble men. And so then he reveals himself. And here you have one of the dramatic scenes in all of Scripture. Joseph sends his Egyptian slaves out of the house. This is a private matter now, just between him and his brothers. And then he cries out. He's had to restrain himself, but you sense now his pent-up emotions just flooding forth. He says, "I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" And he had this intense love for his father. There was indeed a close relationship between Joseph and Jacob. And by asking the question, it also gives a way for the brothers to respond. Now, the brothers, of course, are shocked. And they're, in fact, terrified, as the text says. And Joseph has to go on and reassure them that, yes, indeed, he is Joseph, but also that he has forgiven them. And he tells them, don't be distressed, because it was actually God who sent me ahead of you. That's a remarkable piece of theology. Joseph is showing there an illustration of what we read in Paul later on in Romans chapter 8. In all things, God is working for the good of those who love him. He's saying, yes, this was part of God's plan. It was a bad thing at first. It was hard on me. But in all this, God was working for my good and for your good and also to preserve the covenant family. And I'm going to take care of you now, you and your children, the whole family. I'm going to be God's instruments for preserving you. And so he's reassuring them. Joseph has to do the talking. He has to do the reassuring. And then finally, then, he throws his arms around them, and they weep. And then they are certainly talking with him. The brothers are talking with him. But Joseph has to make the first move here, and he has to reassure them and hug them, and then they will talk with him. So then we have, after that, Joseph sending his brothers back and telling them, bring the family down because I'm going to take care of you. Then the family does come down. This beautiful reunion scene, Jacob and Joseph. And Joseph, according to the directive of Pharaoh, settles them in a very fine portion of Egypt in the land of Goshen where they could carry on well their livelihood of being shepherds. There would be a wonderful pasture land there for their flocks. And then we have Jacob blessing the two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. And then Jacob having a parting word for all of his sons before he dies there in Egypt. And then the last chapter of Genesis, Genesis chapter 50.
We've got just about 30 seconds here before we go to our break.
Okay, I'll do it fast. After the burial of Jacob back in Canaan, then the brothers come to Joseph, and they speak what Jacob had prepared for them, a speech, confessing their sin, basically, and asking Joseph to forgive them. And Joseph weeps. He thought he had already made that clear to them. But he reassures them, yes, I have forgiven you. And then he continues to take care of them. The Genesis closes with the death of Joseph and his wish to be buried, not in Egypt, in a fine tomb, but to be going back to the promised land, to the land of Canaan. And eventually his body will be deposited there in Canaan.
We're talking with Dr. Walter A. Meyer III. The story of Joseph the Patriarch is our subject. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, in the 25 minutes that remain after this break, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We'll delve more deeply into a bit of that theology that Dr. Meyer has been laying out for us when we come back after this.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths into the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly contributor to Issues, Etc. To find out how you can become a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer, check out page 8 of the latest Issues Etc. journal, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation, grace, faith, scripture, for the sake of Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc. and you.
American culture. Now, is it Christian?
Answers with Ken Ham, whose ministry is building a large creation museum near Cincinnati, Ohio.
Well, Ken, there's no doubt that America was once a great Christian nation, but do you think it can still be called that?
Well, frankly, it's no longer the Christian country it used to be. You'd have to say that it's really a post-Christian nation. You see, as you observe the growing humanist philosophy and the increasing abortion, homosexual behavior, pornography and violence, as well as the growing anti-Christian sentiment, you have to conclude that something terrible has happened to this nation. Now, what's happened can be described as a culture shift. You see, generations ago, American society was based on the Bible, and thus people had a Christian morality, well, by and large. But the Bible is no longer the foundation it used to be. Increasingly, it's being replaced by an evolutionary foundation. Thus, people are being taught that man is just an animal, that the Bible is not true. Therefore, people can decide truth for themselves. As a result of this change, the American culture has changed from a Christian one to a secular one. People have no understanding of sin or Christian morality anymore. That's why we need to get people back to the authority of the Word of God, beginning with Genesis.
A major theme of our Answers ministry this year is to confront and refute compromise in the church. One tool to help you is Ken Ham's free booklet on the 6 days of creation. It's available free on our easy-to-use website, AnswersRadio.com. That's AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. According to many teenagers, the louder the music, the better. Some parents joke about their teens losing their hearing. But studies are beginning to show that teen hearing loss is no laughing matter. Exposure to sound levels more than 90 decibels over time will lead to permanent hearing damage. Rock concerts and school dances typically play music which exceed that level. More physicians are starting to become concerned that teens who listen regularly to loud music are causing irreversible damage to their inner ear. The gift of hearing is a blessing from God. With our ears, we can hear music that tells of Jesus and His great love that led Him to die for us. Let's help our children take care of their hearing. Encourage them to turn down the volume. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute at www.cmli.org.
All the plans are made for your upcoming big event. The I's are dotted, the T's are crossed, but how do you let those outside your congregation know about it? The answer is the AM 850 KFUO Datebook. Just send us your information to KFUO Datebook, 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. We'll mention your event at random during our Datebook announcement twice daily on AM 850 KFUO. Again, send your information to Datebook, KFUO Radio, 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. 25 more minutes with Dr. Walter A. Meyer talking about the Old Testament figure of Joseph. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for March deals with a New Testament figure, St. Peter. It's called Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. Now, it's a children's book, so it's a great gift for Easter. And I know Easter's coming up quick, but you can still get this book. I'll tell you how in just a minute. It's a great gift. It's a book about St. Peter and God's mercy and forgiveness shown St. Peter through Jesus Christ. Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net, a good gift for your kids, your grandkids, your godchildren, your nieces, your nephews. Think about Easter gifts when you think about ordering Follow Me. The book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order from Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040 is their number. Call any weekday during regular business hours. 1-800-325-3040, or visit us online at issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section and you'll find information on and a way to order Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. When you call or when you write, make sure you mention Issues Etc. 1-800-325-3040. Oh, by the way, Concordia Publishing House also has two locations in the St. Louis area. You can pick up the book there as well. One at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis. The other here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. Dr. Walter A. Meyer III is our guest. We're talking about Joseph the Patriarch. Dr. Meyer, let's talk a bit about the theology. You ran us through the story. You said at one point that God's hand in this whole story, sometimes obvious, sometimes more subtle, is really something that we cannot miss in the story of Joseph. Tell us about that.
God is directing all the events so that His will is fulfilled. And God is such a powerful God, it's such total control, that these events then will work for the good of Joseph. He is refined. These events will work for the good of his brothers. They are refined. But also then we will have the preservation of the covenant family from starvation. And God could have used these events for other purposes as well. So we see that. We also have the words of Joseph himself when he reveals himself to his brothers. And he says to them, this is in chapter 45, after he says, I am Joseph, is my father still alive? He tells them, come close to me. I am your brother, the one you sold into Egypt. Now, this is ironic. I mean, in a different setting, in a different context, that could have been striking terror in their hearts. But Joseph is using this, you sold me into Egypt, to tell them, yes, I'm really Joseph. But he's using it also to reassure them that, you know, he is their brother and he will take care of them. So he goes on to say this in verse 5, and now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. And then verse 7, but God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So Joseph recognized that, and he's simply confessing this to his brothers. And then in chapter 50, after Jacob has been buried in Canaan, and they've returned, Joseph's brothers are fearful yet, they still are troubled, and they send the word, the speech which Jacob had composed for them, and they are asking now for forgiveness, and Joseph weeps when he gets this because, you know, he's been just trying to show kindness to them and goodness and forgiveness, and this hurts him, but he goes on to tell them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then don't be afraid. So again, that theme comes up in chapter 50. We see here also this whole matter of forgiveness, and that's a key theological point throughout Scripture. God forgives us out of his grace because of the Messiah. And then his people, believers, then forgive each other and also their enemies. And so we learn about forgiveness as well from Joseph.
Does that understanding of God's overarching purpose in his life, that would be Joseph's understanding of how God is using Joseph as an instrument in accomplishing a far vaster plan, his obvious understanding of God's mercy, in that he shows mercy to his brothers, when he could well have condemned them for what they did. He had the power and the authority to do it. And the fact that, you mentioned it before, his desire to follow his father after he is dead, to be buried in Canaan, not where he could have rightfully claimed a tomb among the princes of Egypt, given his position down there. Do all of these kind of come together to show that Joseph had a very solid understanding of the covenant that had been made with Abraham, Isaac, and his father Jacob?
Absolutely. He had a very solid understanding. He was instructed by his father Jacob, and this is the power in his life. It's gospel power. This is what motivates him. He recognizes that he's been forgiven by God. He looks forward to the coming Messiah who will be from the Israelite nation. And motivated by the gospel, he lives his faith, and that includes then showing forgiveness. He's not seeking vengeance, but he rather shows mercy. God has been merciful to him and preserved him and prospered him, and now he, living in knowledge of this truth of the Lord, is going to be acting in the right way with his brothers for their benefit, but then also showing to them love and forgiveness. And this matter of being buried in Canaan, yes, we have the wish of Jacob. He wants to be buried in the promised land because God had said someday the Israelites will possess this land that was given to Abraham. That promise was renewed with Isaac and then also with Jacob. And so they knew that. And Joseph then, in an act of faith, giving a confession there, says, no, I'm not going to have a very fine, beautiful, elaborate pyramid here in Egypt. I want my body someday to be placed in Canaan, the promised land. So he is recognizing that aspect of the covenant as well. So he was very much aware of it, what God spoke first to Abraham and then renewed with Isaac and Jacob. He was aware of all the covenant ramifications, including that promise of the land.
You mentioned God's refining activity, first with Joseph, then through Joseph with his brothers, the same kind of up and down, not only a geographical up and down from Canaan to Egypt, but the up and down of Joseph's own life. He's elevated to Potiphar's house. He goes down to prison. He's a favorite son. Then he's in the cistern. Then he's elevated to Potiphar's house. He's in prison. Then he becomes kind of reaches the pinnacle there. Yet another period of refinement seems to follow here, and that is, if we know the story, of course, what happens after a pharaoh arises that does not know Joseph. The people become slaves. The whole people become slaves.
Yes. Yes, yeah, so that's moving on into the book of Exodus, and that's certainly a change in the lot of the Israelites. Before they had been treated well, and the Egyptians had preserved this memory of Joseph, and they were grateful. But then their lot changes drastically, and they are enslaved. And this makes them long then for freedom. They're ready to leave Egypt and go to the promised land. And so God used that for preparing them for leaving, and it's also the stage then for his performing mighty miracles, both, we could say, in judgment on the Egyptians for their wickedness, but also then demonstrating in an awesome way to his covenant people that he is the covenant God, and he can perform these things as the covenant God.
Are these the kind of things, if you would put yourself in the position of the Israelite who has come out of Egypt out of slavery, who's now in the wilderness on the way to the promised land, wondering whether his next meal is going to be there, are these the kind of things that they would have been passing on to their children, saying God preserved Jacob and his family from starvation? We know that story. God will preserve us as well.
Yeah, they would have passed that on. We certainly would hold to this matter of oral tradition, the truth being passed on orally from one generation to the next. We also have the written records, too. And Moses, then, is the one who finally put all this together and produced, then, the book of Genesis and Exodus, and, in fact, the whole Pentateuch. But the Israelites were very much into remembering and passing on from one generation to the next. And God had different guidelines for them so that they would keep on remembering his commandments and also their history, the annual festivals, and other matters that God directed them to carry out, to constantly have before them their past, the past as a guide for the future.
Why, if Joseph gets 12 chapters of the book of Genesis, why, when eventually in time the land is allotted, Joseph has no land to his name, he has no tribe to his name?
Well, in fact, Joseph has a double portion. And we see that from chapter 48 of Genesis. And Joseph, in essence, is receiving the birthright. Jacob had intended that Rachel, be his wife. But you remember how he was deceived by Laban, and he was tricked into marrying Leah first, and then later on he had Rachel. But Joseph was the firstborn son of his beloved wife, Rachel. And so in that sense, Jacob was intending to give Joseph the birthright. But then technically there was the firstborn son, Reuben, of the wife, Leah. But Reuben lost the birthright because he committed a sexual sin, a violation of his father's bed. And therefore he disqualified himself. And so Jacob then does indeed give the birthright to Joseph. And that meant a double portion for Joseph. And we see that in chapter 48. That's where Jacob then blesses Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And so instead of Joseph simply receiving one portion in Canaan, the promised land, he will receive two. Both Ephraim and Manasseh will have their share in the promised land.
So in this Joseph story, we have far more than simply a way of explaining how they became slaves in Egypt. And we have far more than kind of, as you say, a very compelling story that would have been great fodder for, talking around the campfire with your children. This is a continuation of God's covenant promise.
This is a continuation of God's covenant promise. We see this as we have the history of Jacob and his family, and then a key component in that history is God's using Joseph as his servant. But we also have then, for example, in Genesis chapter 49, the specific indication that the messianic line, which has gone from Adam through Seth, through Noah, through Shem, through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, will continue on through Judah. So the actual messianic line continues on through Judah and then through his tribe. That's in Genesis chapter 49, verses 8 through 10. So that is involved in this. And yes, we have powerful theology in so many ways. As frequently in the Old Testament, theology is lived out in the lives of the people. We see the theology in the history of the nation.
If one of your students at the seminary were to ask you, Dr. Meyer, is there a Christology? Is there a teaching of Christ beyond what you mentioned there of the line of Judah being mentioned prominently in chapter 49 in this little story of Joseph? How would you respond?
I'd respond by saying that underlying this whole book of Genesis is the promise of the Messiah. That goes back to Genesis chapter 3:15. We see God working out the fulfillment of that promise. And that's why the focus is on Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and then their family, the Israelites. Why this one nation out of all the nations of the world, out of all the nations of the ancient Near East? Why focus on Israel? Because God has decided in his grace that from this nation will come the promised deliverer. So that's underlying all these chapters. Then we do have that, yes, specific messianic prophecy in Genesis chapter 49, but in other places earlier on in Genesis, after Genesis 3:15. And then we also have the Messiah in the sense that the gospel, the good news, brings about then the godly lives of these people. And they're showing love and mercy, and also they're showing forgiveness. That's only because of gospel motivation. So that, in a way, also is presenting Christology. They recognize they had forgiveness from God through faith in the coming Messiah. And so then, motivated by that good news, they lived in love and forgiveness with one another. So in those ways, we have Christology.
What about that the person who would look at the figure of Joseph in the various stages of the story and say, I can see also a kind of a prefigurement of Christ in Joseph himself.
Okay. Well, Todd, indeed, some theologians have said that, and I suppose it's just a little variation in emphasis as to how you would interpret the text. When I'm talking about a Christ figure or a type, you know, a foreshadowing of Christ, I myself, Todd, like to have the Bible bring that out explicitly, and so I can do that with regard to Adam, and that's Paul in Romans chapter 5. I can do that with Melchizedek, Genesis chapter 14, that's Psalm 110 and Hebrews chapters 5 and 7. I can do that later on, for example, with David, and then different passages in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. I don't see that explicit identification with regard to Joseph, and therefore I didn't bring that up before, Todd. However, we see with regard to Joseph the spirit of forgiveness and forgiving those who had been his enemies. And so it'd be an easy transition for a pastor in a sermon to say, well, that reminds us of. He may not technically be a type, but this reminds us of Christ. And he was the perfect person who showed perfect forgiveness toward his enemies. And indeed, he's the one who makes forgiveness possible, you know, from God, and then we show forgiveness to one another. This all starts with Christ. It's possible because of the Messiah. So I would find it an easy transition in a sermon, yes.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on Joseph, give us a call now. We'll try and take your phone calls in the last few minutes of our conversation here with Dr. Walter A. Meyer III, Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne. Joseph the Patriarch is our subject. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. A prominent theme that you have mentioned several times here in our conversation is Jacob, in a sense, living by faith. In spite of whatever his circumstances may be, good or bad, he continues to focus upon, at least in a general sense, God's ability to be with him. It's even said several times, as you mentioned, in the text.
Yes, God with him. So Joseph has his trust in the Lord. And going through his hard experiences, he has his pride knocked out of him. He learns to just depend totally on God and on his grace. And he is, again, keeping in mind what Jacob taught to him, the truth as it had been revealed up to that point in time. And so through that truth, and God using his various experiences, he emerges then as a very fine, noble man, and showing his faith in his life. He gives credit to God. When he has this tremendous power in Egypt, there's not a hint of pride on his part, or arrogance, or using his power in the wrong way. Now, he is very careful here, and he's humble before the Lord.
Would it be proper for me to look at Joseph as someone through whom God not only preserves his people, although that's only 75 people, one family, Jacob's offspring, from starvation and brings them down to Egypt, but also he preserves the whole Egyptian people? And if we're given to believe the story here that Egypt is feeding the world at this point, he really is preserving a major portion of mankind in this time of famine through the wisdom God-given, albeit, of Joseph.
Yes, God is preserving a major portion of mankind through the wisdom of Joseph. So, yes, the Israelites are the key focus here, but other peoples benefited from this, starting with the Egyptians, but then we had other peoples in that region because the famine was rather widespread. So Joseph was a blessing not only to his own family, but to many other people as well.
Others have seen parallels between the story of Joseph and the later story, much later in history, of course, and in Scripture, of Daniel, where they both seem, it's not an exact parallel, but they seem to kind of follow in the same general footsteps of an exile being raised because of their God-given wisdom to a place of prominence and power. Do you see that parallel?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting comparison. We have, as you pointed out, Todd, both men had taken off against their will to foreign lands, and it looks bad at first, but then God blesses them in their foreign territories, and he raises them to positions of prominence and influence, and he uses them for the good not only of the Israelites, but also for other peoples as well. And so Daniel is able to, there's another parallel, he's able to interpret a dream. The dream of Nebuchadnezzar. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar cannot even remember his dream. And Daniel has to first of all tell him the dream, and then he gives the interpretation of it. And then Daniel himself goes on to have dreams and visions from God, starting with Daniel chapter 7. So Daniel is a good influence in the life of Nebuchadnezzar, and he's also a very capable administrator. And so he's a good leader in the court of Nebuchadnezzar, and later on, when the Medes and the Persians take over, in the court of Darius the Mede, as mentioned in Daniel chapter 6. So in different ways, yes, we have intriguing parallels with Joseph's story in Genesis.
I guess one just occurred to me that's even more proximate to Joseph, and that's Moses, slave to the household of Pharaoh, back to being an exile, this time out of Egypt, returned at God's command to lead his people out as a great nation.
Right. And there's another Egyptian connection and a little different story there. And then Moses is actually then eventually in a position of antagonism with the Egyptian Pharaoh. And Pharaoh emerges as the enemy here, the real bad guy. And God then gives Moses victory, so to speak, by letting Moses perform these mighty deeds, and then the climax, the miracle at the sea. So, again, we have amazing things taking place, but God is the one who is totally in control, and his will is accomplished.
Dr. Meyer, with only about a minute before we have to wrap this up, what can we here, as the church remembers Joseph the patriarch, what can we take away essentially, what is essential to take away from the story of Joseph?
Well, I'd like to close with a word concerning this whole matter of forgiveness. And we see from Joseph, especially then in chapter 45, when he reveals himself to his brothers, that sometimes you forgive, even if there's no apology coming forth from those who have wronged you. Sometimes it's a matter of forgiving and holding no thought of retaliation. That's always the case, holding no thought of retaliation, of vengeance. Recognizing that at times, you know, God let the wrong happen, but somehow it's according to his purposes. He let it happen, and somehow it's going to work out for your good. So that's why you don't hold a grudge and bitter feelings. And then also, when possible, not only forgiving the wrongdoer, but also helping the wrongdoer. And recognizing that while you have forgiven the wrongdoer once, you may have to do it again in the future to reassure the person and to clear away any roadblocks of misunderstanding.
Dr. Walter A. Meyer, thank you very much for being our guest.
I thoroughly enjoyed it, Todd, and God's blessings to you and your work.
Dr. Walter A. Meyer III, Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, talking about Joseph, the patriarch. You know what God is doing when he gives us, it's not just that Moses found the story compelling and decided to append it to the end of his first book. God inspiring Moses to record these things, stories that probably were told as commonplace stories among God's covenant people in the Old Testament. The reason this one is included, it does make a nice transition, a nice segue between Genesis and Exodus. And it does do a lot to explain how they went from being a small number of people to a great number of people. Free people in their own land as sojourners, promised to them from their grandfather Abraham, to slaves in Egypt on their way back to having that land as a permanent possession. It does all those things, but you know what God is doing? He is showing us how he does things. This is how God always works. He often chooses the least likely, in some cases the least qualified. And through that gift of faith that he gives in his promises, centered in Jesus Christ our Savior, he continues throughout life to refine us, the ups and the downs, the highs and the lows, all for a purpose. All because he desires that we continue steadfast in that faith. He desired not only that Joseph remain steadfast in the faith of the promises he had made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob his father that are culminated in Christ at the cross, but also that through Joseph, the whole people be preserved in that faith. That's precisely what God is doing today. He's guiding each of us through our lives and preserving us steadfast in the faith, so that we might preserve others through that same word of Christ Jesus. Tomorrow on the program, we'll continue our series on the liturgy of sickness, death, and dying with Pastor Will Whedon. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.